Hi, everybody.
Good morning.
The room seems to be set up a little different today. Maybe it's just me. So, usually the talk that's given on Sunday is then the same talk is given on Tuesday. But I gave a talk the last Tuesday. Yeah.
I'll make sure this is
okay.
Projected. We're just not hearing you in the back. I wonder if it's...
Oh, you're not hearing me in the back? Can you hear me now? So the talk I gave the last time I gave a Tuesday talk, I was substituting. And so this time it's going to be reversed. So Tuesday night got it first, parts of it anyway. And this Tuesday night, I won't be speaking Tuesday night. We'll be in retreat. But we will be having the Tuesday night public talk. Tim will be giving it. So that's the plan. Come back on Tuesday and you will hear Tim give a talk. So for those of you who have a program, you know that the talk today, I'm going to be talking about working with difficult emotions. And I'm going to start by telling a story, a very old, very well-known story in Buddhism. It's a Tibetan story about a Tibetan Buddhist master who lived in the 11th century. And this story is about his encounter with his inner demons. Inner demons, Milarepa. So one day Milarepa left his cave. He lived in a cave and meditated all the time. But one day he left to go gather firewood and whatever other errands a person who lives in a cave has to do. But when he returned, he found that his cave was overtaken by demons. And these demons were everywhere. And his first thought was, you know, I got to get rid of them. So he started yelling and lunging and, you know, pitching kind of a fit about the demons being there, trying to chase them out. But the demons were just unfazed. In fact, the more he chased and yelled, the more comfortable they seemed to be. They were just settling in. So realizing that all of his efforts were failing pretty miserably, he decided to teach them about the Dharma. Because he was a Buddhist master, after all. So he started teaching them about the Dharma, preaching to them about the Dharma. Thinking, you know, then perhaps they'll just leave on their own. So he preached to them about an interdependent universe. He preached them to them about kindness and compassion. And when he looked around after a while, he saw that all of them were still there. They just simply stared at him with their big, huge, you know, demon bulging eyes. So it became clear to Milarepa that these demons were not going to be manipulated into leaving. So perhaps he thought perhaps there was something he could learn from them. So he just looked deeply into each of the demons' eyes and he bowed and he said, since we're just going to be here together, I'll just allow myself to learn whatever you have to teach me. And when he did that, some of the demons vanished. And the more he did that, one by one, more of the demons vanished. But there was one that didn't. There's always one that doesn't, right? And this one was huge and it was fierce. His nostrils were flaring. You know how they do that? fangs flashing. So then Milarepa just surrendered completely. Just totally surrendered. He said, "Eat me if you wish." I guess that's how you surrender to a demon. You say, "Eat me if you wish." And then he put his head into the demon's mouth, and the demon dissolved. The demon dissolved, and this great spaciousness, a great calmness, infused Milarepa, and his cave was completely still and peaceful. So that's the story. So first I want to talk a little bit about the word demon. It came from the Greek word daimon, spelled D-A-I-M-O-N, which actually means a lesser god or a spirit or a tutelary deity. And as a matter of fact, in his book, Rudolf Steiner, if you've heard of Rudolf Steiner, he wrote a book called Christianity as Mystical Fact and the Mysteries of Antiquity. He wrote that a demon is a mediator between the earthly and the divine. So often when they're distinguishing between that kind of demon, the mythological, the classical idea of demon, they'll pronounce it a little different. They'll pronounce it daemon or daemon, something like that. I'm not going to do that. It feels a little clunky. I'm just going to pronounce it as demon. But for the next, 45 minutes or so, just kind of come along with me and go with the classical definition of demon as being more of a spiritual guide. Not an evil something with fangs and flaring nostrils. So it's kind of unfortunate, I think, that the word got hijacked by those who are bent on dividing everything up into good and evil. But that's what happens. That's what happens in our culture. So Carl Jung said that we don't become enlightened by imagining beings of light, but by making the darkness conscious. So the story of Milarepa is also about making the darkness conscious. And the mythological image of a cave, as all of us know by now, at least all of us who have ever seen Star Wars, making the mythological image of a dark cave is also about making the darkness conscious. In Buddhism, we talk a lot about purifying the emotions, which is also making the darkness conscious. But we don't use the word purify in the Christian sense. In the Christian sense, it's about purging out evil. But in the Buddhist sense, when we talk about purifying the emotions, we're talking about clarifying the emotions. We're actually talking about cultivating the ability to experience our emotions in a pure way, to experience the actual sensation of an emotion without all of our emotional reactivity, our judgments about the emotions, our criticism about the emotions, the stories that we tell about the emotions, which is just a way of avoiding whatever we're experiencing in our body. It's a way of escape. So in a well-known exchange between Buddha and his attendant, Ananda, Ananda said to the Buddha, "Relationships are half the holy life." And Buddha said, "Don't say that, Ananda, don't say that. Relationships are the whole of holy life." But the relationships that I'm going to be talking about this morning are our inner relationships. Because the relationships that we have on the outside with those around us are just kind of a manifestation of what's going on inside us. And I think we all kind of know that. We're holding a lot of anger inside us. You know, it's going to affect our relationships. So the story of Milarepa is also about cultivating a relationship with our emotions. So also, you know, today I'll be using the words negative and positive, negative emotions, positive emotions. And again, not in the sense of good or bad. Negative in the sense that it causes suffering. And, you know, that's important to point out because more and more today, people are feeling shame and guilt over feeling their negative emotions. You know, we're such a culture now of self-help books and that now people are actually feeling guilt and shame when they don't feel upbeat all the time. So although positive emotions are worth cultivating, and we know that, but it's problematic when we think that we should be feeling upbeat and positive all the time. In fact, anger and sadness are a very important part of life, and research has even shown that experiencing and accepting these emotions are vital to our well-being. Pain is a natural occurrence. Emotional pain is a natural occurrence. And we will feel physical pain and emotional pain as long as we're alive. And when we've suffered some kind of loss, emotional loss, the most natural thing in the world is to experience grief and sadness. Grieving is how we heal. Grieving is how we heal. And Zen practice is about acknowledging and accepting the complexities of life. Things are not good or evil. You know, things are not white or black or even gray. I mean, life is nuanced. Life is complicated. So today I'm mostly talking about, as I was thinking about this, I'm talking about transforming suffering to grace. And so suffering. Learning to recognize suffering as suffering is a pretty difficult thing for us as human beings. So for many of us, we define well-being, for instance, as the presence of just positive emotions, like I was just saying. But that attitude in itself can produce suffering because it's just not congruent with the messiness of life. And if we're just, you know, trying to be upbeat all the time, then, you know, that's not congruent with the messiness of life either. We can start to feel complacent, and life can be pretty unforgiving if we get too complacent. So now grace. I said transforming suffering to grace. And the way I'm using the word grace today is as a kind of agility, a kind of ease, a refinement in our approach to life and our perception of the world and how we fit into it. So it's a quality of spiritual freedom. And it grows out of a willingness to accept life as it is, to accept the complexity of life. So I'm going to talk about four ways of working with difficult emotions. The four ways are willingness and removing yourself from the center, reversing the story, and send them love. So those four ways. So willingness, and I'm going to start with a story that just kind of, that reveals how blind we can be by what is actually going on inside us. And if you were in practice period, this past practice period, you heard this story. This story is about a woman who goes to her therapist. I'm going to call her Jane. And she goes to a therapist because she wants help quitting smoking. Now, this woman is in her 40s. She smoked all of her adult life, and she's tried to quit many times. So now she's going to the therapist for help. So he starts talking to Jane about her cravings. He starts talking to her about being aware of her cravings and what they feel like, journaling about the intensity of her cravings over time, this sort of thing, you know. And suddenly Jane stops him, and she says, "What are you talking about? I don't have cravings. I just smoke." So the therapist says to her, "Okay, but just try this and see what happens. Just try keeping track of your thoughts before you light up a cigarette. Just try it." So she agrees to give it a try. She comes back a week later, and she says, "I've been tracking my cravings. I've been tracking them all the time. And now I can't quit thinking about smoking. What do I do?" So not only was Jane unwilling to have some kind of a relationship with her cravings, she was not even aware that they were in the room. Maybe a little bit like Milarepa. Do you think the demons were in his cave before he went chopping wood? Or did they just suddenly show up? They were always there. But at first, Milarepa, kind of like this woman, Jane, was in all-out aversion mode. And when we're in all-out aversion mode, we're not even aware of what's going on inside us. We're not even aware of what's driving us. So it isn't our strong emotions that cause us to suffer. This is one of Buddha's most fundamental teachings. It's not our strong emotions that cause us to suffer. It's our aversion to strong emotions. So that's Buddha's second noble truth, is that suffering is caused by desire and aversion. So the second way that I want to talk about, removing yourself from the center. And Zen practice is all about decentering, which allows us to just focus on what's going on in a non-self-referential way. In other words, it allows us to get our desires and aversions out of the way so that we can see the world as it actually is. And pretty much everything that we learn in Zen is pointing to that one teaching, or that one ability or willingness to get ourselves out of the way, decentering. Even Zen paintings. You know, if you look at a Zen painting, there's usually it's usually some kind of a nature scene. Often there's a waterfall, a lot of greenery, Often there's a lot of mist, which kind of indicates the mystery. And somewhere in all that background, there's a little bitty person. Not standing out at all. Nothing there to draw your eyes to him. He's just right there. A part of nature and whatever is going on. Compare that to a Western painting. I mean, there we are, front and center, right? Even if it's some kind of painting about, I don't know, somebody fishing, a fishing boat, a fisherman in a fishing boat, there's always something there to draw our attention to this person, right? I mean, that's kind of the craft. But in Zen, it's not like that. And another example, Zen poetry, a haiku. Probably one of the most well-known Zen haiku poets is a guy named Basho. And one of his most well-known poems or haikus is this. A still pond, a frog leaps in, plop. Just that. He's not the center of his experience. Basho is nowhere to be found in that haiku. It's not told from a certain perspective. You know, I mean, Basho is not saying it's a beautiful still pond. You know, he's not saying the frog is green or colored or small or large or ugly with bulging eyes. He's just nowhere to be found. So decentering, getting ourselves out of the way. Getting ourselves out of the way, getting ourselves out of the center, is what happiness is all about from a Zen point of view. Because the ability to see without judging or comparing or reminiscing, the ability to stay right in the present with what's going on, with crisp clarity, where everything is fresh. That's from a Zen point of view, that is happiness. So that is grace, the way I'm using the word grace today. So the third thing, reversing the story that fuels the emotion. This came from during this last practice period, Tim talked about reversing the story. He used to have a practice of reversing the story. So I did a little research into this idea of reversing the story because, you know, it sounded a lot like the trickster in mythology. And what's also called a contrarian in indigenous cultures. And I learned about among the Lakota people, the contrarian is called a heyoka. A heyoka? Anybody heard of a heyoka? You, Tim, you heard of heyoka? I thought you probably had. So the heyoka is a contrarian, a jester, and a kind of a sacred clown. But he speaks, moves, and reacts in an opposite fashion to the people around him. So the heyoka functions as both as a mirror and a teacher. He uses extreme behavior to mirror the behavior of others so that they can see it, forcing them to examine their own behavior, forcing them to see their own doubts and hatreds and weaknesses. And also the Heyoka has, they have the power to heal emotional pain. This is kind of an interesting way for a culture to deal with working with emotions, right? To recognize emotions. So we have our way of doing it. We have the therapists, and we have psychologists, and we have lots and lots of pills. But what if we just had a Heyoka just running around, mirroring what we're doing, just showing us something? And they often will sing songs about shameful events in their own lives. They'll beg for food, and they live as clowns. So they provoke laughter in distressing situations. And they provoke fear and chaos when people feel too complacent or overly secure. We could use a few of those. Because they keep people from taking themselves too seriously, or from believing that they're more powerful than they actually are. So there's a long tradition of reversing the story. And now I want to read a story. It's a pretty powerful example of reversing the story. This is in a book. This is in Search Inside Yourself. And this is a story told by Jon Kabat-Zinn. I'm just going to read it to you. This is a story about a man in his mindfulness-based stress reduction clinic. And here's what Jon Kabat-Zinn said about him. He said, another man in his early 70s came to the clinic with severe pain in his feet. He came to the first class in a wheelchair. That first day, he told the class that the pain was so bad, he just wanted to cut off his feet. He didn't see what meditating could possibly do for him, but things were so bad that he was willing to give anything a try. Everybody felt incredibly sorry for this man. He came to the second class on crutches rather than in a wheelchair. And then after that, from the third class on, he used only a cane. The transition from wheelchair to crutches to cane spoke volumes to us all as we watched him from week to week. He said at the end of the course that the pain hadn't changed much. The pain hadn't changed much. But his attitude toward his pain had changed a lot. Reversing the story. And that's pretty powerful, huh? Who's heard of the platitude, there but by the grace of God go I? You guys have heard that? There but by the grace of God go I. It's attributed to John Bradford, a 16th century evangelical preacher. He said that when he was, as he was watching criminals being led to the scaffold. There but by the grace of God go I. But if we reverse that story, we get there by the grace of God go I. Which I believe is a deeper truth. There by the grace of God go I. The deeper truth is, as long as there's suffering in the world, none of us are free of it. And that's the grace. We're all one. Another example of reversing the story. A disciple asked the rabbi, why does Torah tell us to place these words upon our hearts? Why does it not tell us to place these holy words in our hearts? The rabbi answered, it is because as we are, our hearts are closed, and we cannot place the holy words in our hearts. So we place them on top of our hearts, and there they stay until one day, the heart breaks, and the words fall in. So that was a tale told by Rilke. And it reverses the story of a broken heart as being a source of suffering to a broken heart being a source of peace and of openness. And in the Milarepa story, you know, he reversed the story several times. I mean, at first he was chasing them off, then he was welcoming them, then he was preaching to them, and then he was listening to them. So reversing the story. And now the last one. Send them love. Send them love. I listen to a lot of TED Talks on YouTube. And not too long ago, I heard a TED Talk about an American psychologist who went to a forest monastery in Southeast Asia for 6 months. And he said it was the most painful, unpleasant 6 months of his life. And when he arrived, he asked, "Is it true that there's poisonous snakes here in the compound?" And the monk told him, "Oh, yes, yes, deadly, deadly." So walk very carefully, very mindfully. Carry a flashlight at night. Pat down your meditation cushions before you sit on them. And send them love. Send them love. So often we hear people ask, why is there so much evil in the world and what can I do about it? Well, I think that we can begin by accepting the complexities of life and stop dividing everything up into good and evil. Because if something is evil, then we have to cast it out of our hearts, right? And outside our hearts, nothing can be done. But if our heart is open, that same question becomes, why is there so much forgetting in the world? Why is there so much blindness in the world, so much heartache in the world? Why is there so much fear and unfulfilled longing? And then the answer is clear, to love. So send them love is the fourth way that that I want to talk about working with strong emotions. But how do we do that? How do we send love to our strong emotions? But when we talk about transformation in Zen, we're talking about a movement towards liberation. So when we think about transforming our strong emotions, our negative emotions, it's helpful to think about transformation in that way, in the sense of liberating. So using this language, when a strong emotion arises and begins its movement towards liberation, at first we may get a sense of a separate self sort of surrounding this very intense energy as it's arising. I mean, if you're really paying attention, like in meditation, when fear arises or anger arises, it can feel very tight, very tightly wound energy. You might get a sense of self kind of surrounding that. If you can pay very close attention, you might also get a sense of your aversion to experiencing this very tightly wound, chaotic, intense energy. This is a subject-object orientation. But if we can just stay there with it, with our kind awareness, with our kind open awareness, then things might start to shift a little bit. Because open awareness, kind awareness, is unbounded. And it will start to seep into this very chaotic, very intense energy, and start to open it up a little bit. The boundary between the sense of self and the strong emotion starts to soften. So there's a merging. Milarepa put his head right into the mouth of the demon. There's a merging. So at this point, it might feel a little bit like you're holding on to a live wire. I know that feeling. But it's just energy. It feels very viscous. Feels very disruptive. But from the very first time we sit on the cushion, we start learning, experiencing how everything comes and goes. Naturally as the breath, if there's no aversion and if there's no clinging. So we can actually start experiencing this with something as viscous and disruptive as a strong emotion. It comes and goes just as naturally as the breath. Stays a little while longer, I know. But it's really very fragile. I mean, it feels so powerful, but it's very fragile. It's so fragile that the merest thought that this shouldn't be happening, that I don't want to feel that. And the subject-object orientation returns. But if we can just be with that preference, just be with that aversion, just soften into it, then the boundaries start to soften again. And this dance could go on for a long time. There's no way to tell or predict. But over time, as we learn to just stay with it, the sense of a centralized self, a subject relating to an object, relaxes more and more. And like Milarepa, our sense of self relaxes into a great spaciousness, a great calmness. And it may only last for a few moments. But those are moments that we are not relating to life from a subject-object orientation. And the lived experience of spaciousness arises within our consciousness. And the more we can do this, but not as a technique. At first it's going to feel like a technique. But the more we can do this as a natural and ordinary expression of our beingness, that's when we begin to cultivate the capacity to hold a non-dual consciousness. This is really important work we're doing. It's really important work. It's very subtle. It's very important. Very important for the individual. Very important for humanity. So I have one more story for you this morning. And this is a story about how transforming fear into grace may just save the world. So this is a story that was told by a reporter who was in Iraq in 2005. And this reporter was embedded with a small unit of soldiers. And this unit was on foot and headed towards a mosque. And they were in a town, I can't remember the name of the town, but it was a town that was a real hot spot for violence. There had just been a lot of uprising and threats going on. So this small unit of soldiers in full battle gear and armor were walking down the street, walking towards a mosque. Now, their intention was to defend the mosque because there had been threats. But, as you can imagine, the Iraqis who are traumatized, they see this unit of soldiers walking towards their mosque, And the first thing they think is that they're going to desecrate the mosque in some way. So suddenly, hundreds of Iraqis come pouring out of the buildings on both sides of the street. And they are filled with fear and rage. They're yelling, they're pumping their fists, they're threatening. This is a very, very tense moment. As a matter of fact, the reporter who told the story said that he thought, you know, this is it. This is going to be the next tragedy in the Iraq War. He said he felt that a shot was going to come out from somewhere, and then the soldiers were going to open fire on this crowd of civilians, and the world would witness a massacre by the Iraqis, by the American soldiers. So this is what the reporter was bracing himself for. But then suddenly, an American officer stepped forward from the unit. He stepped forward and he held his weapon upside down like this, pointing to the ground. He held it just like this. And the reporter said that it was a powerful gesture. As a matter of fact, he called it almost biblical, was the phrase that he used. And then this commander, this officer, holding his weapon upside down like this, he turned to the unit and he commanded them to take a knee. Take a knee, he said. And as you can imagine, the soldiers were reluctant. They were filled with fear. But one by one, they began to take a knee, you know, wavering quite a bit with all their heavy armor and weapons. One by one, they took a knee, went down on one knee, and they turned their weapon upside down and pointed it to the ground. The Iraqis fell silent, and their anger subsided. And then the officer ordered the soldiers to withdraw, and they turned and walked away from the mosque. So, transforming fear into grace. And if that can happen in a military setting, in the front line of a war zone, then that can really change the world. So I'm going to end with a quote. This is by a guy I've never heard of. I can't even really pronounce his name, Vaclav Havel. But I love the quote. Have you heard of him? Okay. Here's what he said. I think there are good reasons for suggesting the modern age has ended. Many things indicate that we're going through a transitional period where it seems that something is on the way out and something else is painfully being born. It is as if something were crumbling, decaying, and exhausting itself, while something else, still indistinct, were rising from the rubble. So this birthing of something new happens from within, and then it radiates outward, just as it did with the American officer. Just as it's doing everywhere, I think. So that's what I have to say today. Anybody have any questions or comments? Story? Yeah. Oh, hi. Hi, James, and back.
I thought it was an interesting comparison of been practiced to decenter when, in another sense, coming to the cushion and being present with the senses is, and becoming focused can be described as center. But to your point about dealing with difficult emotional energy, and Milarepa sticking his head into the demon's mouth, the one demon that there was no other approach to, as being decentering, I think is another good comparison for what happened. And after that, you're still sitting there. You're still sitting there on the cushion after you've been developed by the demon. And that's a valuable practice, I think, to come out unscathed through that decentering experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm almost loathe to ask this question because it's so technique and your outfits are really beautiful. But the willingness, the first thing, the willingness to be with the emotions, I mean, to me, I think that relates to, you know, not telling the story of the emotions, but perpetuating it and focusing on that. You know, I struggle with, I try to bring myself to the emotions, but the stories keep coming and coming. I don't know how to approach that.
Well, we learn to do it by doing it over and over and over. And I would suggest, rather than sitting down and, you know, trying to dig up an emotion so you can experience it, just sit and follow your breath and be with whatever arises. With your awareness, not being, you know, caught up in it and taken away with it. And when this coupling of thought and storytelling is an evolutionary thing. I mean, you know, we evolved to couple very quickly. We have a some kind of emotion, particularly a negative emotion. Then immediately there's thought. And the very first one was probably, you know, the fear arising and the thought run. You know, saved many lives, you know, run. And now that coupling happens so fast that we can't really stop it from happening as it's happening until we've meditated long enough and regularly enough to slow that process down a little bit. So in the beginning, we usually will not catch the storytelling until it's off somewhere in the middle of the story. But then we just let it go and bring ourselves back into the, back to our breath, because by then the sensation is probably gone by then, because you've been up here with the storytelling. And so the sensation just kind of settles back into our body. But it will arise again, and regular meditation practice allows you to catch the storytelling sooner and sooner and sooner, and eventually you'll be able to catch it as it's arising and just let it go. And then there's the ability to just stay with the emotion. But that's something you have to work towards, and who knows how long it's going to take. You know, it has to do with your commitment. But eventually, if your practice is sincere, you will cultivate the ability to just stay right with the emotion. And then you might experience what I described in the talk. You might experience this emotion feeling like the tightly bound energy. And you might think of it as energy rather than putting some negative connotation on it. 'Cause that's going to allow you to just be open to it. Does that make sense? Thank you for the question. Anybody else?
Why does that happen?
Sure.
So I agree that regular meditation can be helpful.
Mm-hmm. That's good. You're in the right place to agree with that.
And I question whether the officer was a Zen practitioner.
Oh, I question that also, which makes it even better.
Yes. So somehow he came to this good place.
Well, the part of the story that I left out was that the reporter actually went and looked him up years later, after they were both back in the States. And he asked him the question, the language that he used was, he asked him, how did you learn to tame a crowd like that? But the answer that the officer said was that it was just a gesture of respect. He was just being right there with them, opening up to them, being aware of, being aware of their trauma and being aware of the situation and just responding from a place of compassion. And we learn how to do this in lots of ways. I mean, in Zen, and the most proven way is through meditation, but because compassion is our natural state of being, we can learn it. Everything in life is a teacher that will, if we ride it all the way down, as Tim says, it will allow us to tap into our natural state of compassion and respectfulness. So, it shouldn't be an oddity that happened, right? It shouldn't be a story that we tell. It should just be something that's as natural as breathing. But it's not. Anybody else? Thank you.